This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Michael Rowland, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Coming up, Parliament has returned for a fortnight with a few wrinkles needing ironing out. Barnaby Joyce has one foot out the door of the National Party room as a looming showdown over climate policy threatens to engulf the coalition. And can the government finally settle on its environmental reforms? Chief political correspondent with The Conversation, Michelle Grattan, joins me in a moment. Also ahead, there was outrage recently when Big Four consultancy Deloitte got busted using dodgy artificial intelligence in a government report. But the academic who blew the whistle says we missed the point, that our welfare payment system is in crisis. And a celebration of all things Novocastrian.
Newcastle still has that element of grit, but I think that grit is our determination to hold on to the fact we are not an extension of Sydney, and Lord forbid, we are not a part of Sydney. We are very much our own people.
Lord forbid, former ABC foreign correspondent Scott Bevan joins me to talk about his new book, A Love Letter to His Hometown. Well, Parliament's back, and with more of a whimper than a bang. At the top of the agenda for this fortnight, the passage of long-awaited reforms to the nation's environmental laws, known as the EPBC Act. The minister responsible, Murray Watt, says he's determined to see it passed by the end of the year, but both the Greens and the Coalition are raising objections. Meanwhile, the Nationals have been confronted with a Barnaby Joyce-shaped hole in their party room after the member for New England declared he would not join their meeting today as he contemplates a future with One Nation. Mr. Joyce says he can't be part of a party that's committed to net zero, a policy platform that's also threatening to tear the Liberals apart. Rising above the fray, quite literally, is the Prime Minister, who jetted off to Malaysia yesterday for the ASEAN Leaders Summit before continuing on to South Korea for APEC. Michelle Grattan is Chief Political Correspondent with The Conversation, and she joins me now. Michelle, welcome back to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks, Michael.
So much to talk about. Let's start with the Nationals. They met today to hear from Senators Matt Canavan and Ross Cadell, who've been reviewing the party's energy policy. But Michelle, the Nats are yet to announce their position on net zero, but the debate in the party is really only going in one direction, isn't it?
Well, I think so, although I think that David Littleproud, the leader, is still acknowledging that maybe, just maybe, net zero needs to be in there somewhere. Or at least he is saying that they need an alternative policy. They can't just have a dumping of net zero. Now, today was a meeting where they heard a report from Matt Canavan, who's been looking into the alternative to net zero, but they didn't make any decision. And, of course, Barnaby Joyce, who's the great opponent of net zero, didn't turn up. He hasn't moved out of the National Party. He was sitting with the Nationals in Parliament today, but he's moved out of the party room, so he's not attending meetings.
What do you make of that decision by Barnaby Joyce? He's still sitting with his colleagues on the floor of the Parliament, but not attending party meetings. What do you make of that?
Well, look, I reckon that what happened there was that he had this plan to go to One Nation, but it was he was caught out when it was leaked prematurely, and that sort of left him somehow hoist in the middle on this journey, and he didn't quite know what to do, how to execute his next move. And, of course, there was a lot of pressure from the Nationals' colleagues to stay in the party. So he's come up with this sort of compromise of not attending the party meetings because he said he couldn't go backwards, the political marriage, as it were, had fallen apart. But on the other hand, he obviously didn't want to completely determine where he was going to end up, at least at this point. So he's in a very awkward position, but he's made it all about Barnaby, as so often is the case with him, and he's still getting a lot of publicity. He's still doing all these interviews, but the situation sounds really confused.
Yes, well, it is very confusing. You're so right. He's still popping up on every show available. Do you expect him, Michelle, to eventually defect to One Nation?
You'd have to think that's the most likely outcome. And it's quite interesting that today Pauline Hanson is saying that it's going to be no longer called Pauline Hanson One Nation. It's just going to be called One Nation. Now, whether that's significant in the whole Barnaby Joyce thing, I guess time will tell. But certainly I think that Pauline Hanson, while she might support Barnaby Joyce leading the party one day after she wants to give up the leadership, she doesn't want that to happen anytime soon. She wants to have a few more years in that job, I think. So from her point of view too, the leak of that story to the Sydney Morning Herald was really inconvenient timing.
Net Zero is quite divisive in the Liberal Party room as well. You wrote for The Conversation, Michelle, last week that the Liberal Party returning to a debate over climate change is like dogs returning to their vomit. Quite the colourful analogy. Why is this so potentially damaging for the Liberal Party?
Now, I must say on the dogs, this was a line that Paul Keating used to use in an entirely different context. But when I looked it up, I found that it was actually a biblical proverb. So you learn something every day, as they say. Why is it so divisive? Well, it's because the party is really split between the urban constituency, fewer and fewer urban members, of course, but people who are looking to that constituency, and they know that voters in urban areas are committed to the concept of net zero, even if there's increasing concern about the practicality of it, and especially young voters, women voters. And so to jettison net zero is politically very, very potentially damaging in those seats. On the other hand, of course, they also have, the Liberals also have country seats and outer suburban seats, and especially in the regional areas, net zero is not so popular at all. So the Liberals are having great trouble, I think, coming to some compromise which takes account of both constituencies, which in fact pays some sort of lip service to net zero, but loosens the constraints that a commitment would put on a future coalition government. It's worth remembering too, Michael, of course, that the Liberals and the Nationals signed up to net zero when Scott Morrison was Liberal Prime Minister. Moreover, the Nationals signed up to it when Barnaby Joyce was leader, but at the same time, while he did the deal with Morrison on net zero, he personally opposed that deal. So go figure that.
Go figure that. You could spend months working that out. You also write in The Conversation, Michelle, that twice in recent times the Liberals have faced what you described as an existential crisis over climate and energy policy back in 2009, and that was over then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's carbon pollution reduction scheme. Then in 2018, over the ill-fated National Energy Guarantee, and you also point out on both occasions it blew up Malcolm Turnbull's leadership. In 2009, he was opposition leader. In 2018, of course, he was Prime Minister. Is Susan Lee's leadership at stake here?
Well, it has the potential to blow up Susan Lee's leadership, because while I think she has the numbers in the party room at the moment and her position might even be a bit stronger than it was when she was so narrowly elected leader, nevertheless, things are pretty unstable. And if she can't craft an acceptable compromise on net zero, then I think her leadership will be shaken. I'm not saying that she would fall immediately. I think that there's a recognition in the Liberal Party that it would be very damaging to be seen to overthrow their first Liberal female leader prematurely, but I think that there's also a general recognition that Susan Lee is probably pretty unlikely to go to the next election, and certainly very unlikely to go to the one after that, because most people think that the Liberals will be in opposition for at least two terms.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. I'm Michael Rowland, and I'm speaking to Michelle Grattan, Chief Political Correspondent with The Conversation. Michelle, let's go to that key piece of legislation that's expected to be tabled this sitting fortnight, perhaps this week, and that's that long-awaited reform of the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, or EPPC, a process that began back in 2019 when the then Minister for the Environment, Susan Lee, commissioned a review by the former ACCC Chair, Graham Samuel. Now, Michelle, successive governments have dragged their heels on this for 5 years. At the same time, Australia's natural environment has continued to degrade. Why has this particular issue, this legislation, been so difficult?
Well, I guess because there are various stakeholders with different interests in this. There's the business community, and of course that breaks up into sections, and the environmentalists, and there's just been no ability so far to bridge the differences between them. Now, there was nearly a deal last term when Tanya Plibersek was Environment Minister, but that fell over for various reasons, including a looming WA election where the Labor government wasn't happy with progress towards a deal. So we're back again with a new minister, Murray Watt. Murray Watt, a tough Queenslander, is Mr. Fix-It, and he's pretty determined to try to fix it this time.
Susan Lee really risks being out on a limb here, doesn't she, if she doesn't cut a deal? Today, Brian Black, the head of the Business Council of Australia, urged the coalition not to delay this any longer. On Friday, we saw similar criticism from Graham Samuel himself, who questioned whether the Liberal leader was playing political games. Do you think the coalition will dig their heels in, or eventually, I don't know, capitulate or at least compromise?
Well, it's always risky to predict, Michael, but I think in the end the coalition's likely to compromise. I think we're in this stage where everybody's sort of angry, performatively angry, if I could put it that way. So you see the Libs saying this is all terrible. You see the Nats, although they probably need to be taken more seriously, because when they say things are terrible, they often mean it and are pretty reluctant to compromise. But anyway, they're saying it's bad. And of course, the Greens are arcing up as well. But I think that when we get beyond this stage, the government is willing to be flexible. I think, as you point out, the Liberals are under pressure from business. Business would prefer, firstly, action, but secondly, they would prefer a deal between the government and the opposition than between the government and the Greens. So I think that this is a staged process, and eventually they will get to some sort of compromise.
Okay, watch this space. Meantime, I guess the happiest man in Australian politics, looking over at the other side, is the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. He is overseas again. He's going to ASEAN and APEC. Just want to get your thoughts on the Prime Minister's trip today. He met with the Chinese Premier Li Qiang on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit. What do we know about their discussions, and how important is any engagement between Australia and China at leader level?
Well, it's always important, and we don't know a lot about that engagement today, Michael, because the Prime Minister sometimes is very willing to talk about meetings with others, and at other times he's more keeping the lips closed, and it was the latter today. They did talk about the incident involving an Australian military plane over the South China Sea when the Chinese put up some flares near it. And also they talked about the critical minerals deal that the Prime Minister did in Washington, but Anthony Albanese wasn't to be drawn in detail on those things.
The Prime Minister also met with Japan's new Prime Minister, their first female Prime Minister, Sanae Takeuchi, last night. Do you think he's feeling, generally speaking, pretty pumped up, Michelle, following last week's undoubtedly successful visit to Washington and to the White House with Donald Trump?
I think he's absolutely pumped up. Of course, the new Japanese leader is at the other end of the political spectrum, but they look to be happily having their first meeting together. And I noticed that the Prime Minister was telling the journalists again to keep up. he said that in the last few days when they were somewhere else, I've forgotten where, but I think he really feels he's out there in front. He's got past that early meeting, that first meeting with the American president, and that was a roaring success for him. A bit embarrassing for Kevin Rudd, but nevertheless, overall, obviously something of a triumph in the Prime Minister's eyes, and I think that he knows that in the rest of summit or in this summit season, really things are unlikely to go wrong for him. There's not a lot at stake and he's enjoying it, although he's probably exhausted. I think he is exhausted.
Yes, he probably would. Any human being would, given the air miles he's racked up in recent weeks. Michelle, thank you so much for joining me.
Good to talk, Michael.
Good to talk to you as always. Michelle Grattan is Chief Political Correspondent with The Conversation and Professorial Fellow at the University of Canberra. Coming up, Lonely Planet once named it one of the world's top 10 cities, just don't call it part of Sydney. Former ABC correspondent Scott Bevan joins me to talk about his new book celebrating his hometown, Newcastle.
This is Michael Rowland, sitting in for Fran Kelly on the Radio National Hour.
Earlier this month, Big Four consultancy Deloitte was forced to apologise and issue a refund after it was revealed that a report it had prepared for the government had been generated in part by artificial intelligence. The $440,000 report contained AI hallucinations, including a made-up quote from a federal court judgment and non-existent academic references. University of Sydney legal scholar Dr. Christopher Rudge was the first to raise the alarm, prompting an embarrassing mea culpa by Deloitte and yet more scorn heaped on the government's reliance on external consultants. But the report was also a sincere attempt to assess the efficiency of the Albanese government's automated system for imposing penalties and cancelling the payments of welfare recipients. And its findings were alarming. For more on this, I'm happy to say I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Christopher Rudge. Dr. Rudge, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Your discovery that parts of this report was generated by artificial intelligence became a pretty explosive and certainly an embarrassing story there for a few weeks, but it meant that a different story was pretty much buried. Just tell us why you were looking at that Deloitte report in the first instance.
Well, at its heart, this is a story of profound administrative failure. In August this year, the Commonwealth Ombudsman confirmed that for over 2 years, the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations had been unlawfully cancelling the job seeker payment in Australia. Now, that's a payment of around $800 a fortnight for people who are unemployed and have, you know, passed the eligibility test for that benefit. And it was being unlawfully cancelled at a rate of about a dozen Australians every single day since 2022.
Okay, so job seekers are required to meet certain obligations or under what's called the targeted compliance framework. But according to the federal government, nearly 1,000 people had their payments unlawfully terminated automatically. How did that happen?
Well, the system was designed, it was actually goes back to 2018, and the automated process of cancelling payments was there from that starting point. But interestingly, back in 2022, under the coalition government at the time, amendments were made to the law, and this is in the wake of the robo-debt settlement hearing in 2019. But even so, the lessons of the robo-debt media reporting were still apparent. And so the Minister, Stuart Robert, at the time introduced a legislative amendment which set out a blueprint for a new, highly automated welfare model for job seekers, now known as Workforce Australia. But in the context of making these 22 amendments, there were two, I guess, protections introduced that effectively recognised and acknowledged that the new digital system for job seekers did contain risks. The first was a digital protections framework. So this set out a requirement that the department introduced this framework, and it was supposed to really be the legal fire alarm system. It would basically set out the rights of people who were in the job seeker system and ensure that they were afforded natural justice and so forth. Another change was made to fix what had become a notoriously inefficient part of the old system. People would often miss their obligations under this so-called mutual obligation system. And they would often do so for very reasonable excuses. For example, they might be in hospital or they might be taking care of a sick child. What was happening was these people would be automatically cancelled, and then, you know, possibly months of bureaucracy would follow. And at the end of all of the paperwork exchanging and double checking, they would be reinstated. The government at the time thought this was inefficient and also recognised that it was just a waste of everyone's time. So they actually removed the auto cancellation mechanism and instead said, well, let's put a decision maker up at the very front of this and introduced a law that said there should be a discretionary judgment made at the very start before someone's payment is cancelled. Now, the shocking reality, as the Ombudsman found this year, is that the department has failed to implement either of these two legal changes since the 22 amendments.
Do we know why they didn't?
Well, in recent Senate committee inquiries, the Secretary for the department, Natalie James, has said on the first plank here, the digital protections framework, that a whole of government response was required after the Robodebt Royal Commission, and the department are waiting until that whole of government response can be organised to establish its own departmental digital protections framework. On the other point, the Ombudsman has effectively made the accusation that the cancellations are unlawful. And the Secretary has known of this since 2024, of the accusation. But obviously, with any legal accusation, before it goes to the court or before advice is received by government, there needs to be a response that is relatively thorough and exacting. And as part of that response, that is what led the Secretary to commission Deloitte to undertake this huge assurance report, which ultimately concluded that, yes, the Ombudsman's accusation has merit, and it appears that there are many unlawful cancellations. As I said, a dozen a day, over 10,000 on the initial mathematics, happening since 2022.
Before we drill further into a Deloitte report, I've read, Christopher, a lot of Ombudsman's reports in my time. This one was particularly scathing, wasn't it, about what happened in terms of the impact on vulnerable people?
Yeah, I think that since the Robodebt Royal Commission, the Ombudsman, one might recall, did not actually give evidence at the Royal Commission. But the Ombudsman has, I must say, taken a concerted effort to really focus in on complaints in the social security system. And I think this is another iteration of the kind of proactive approach taken by the Ombudsman since the Robodebt Royal Commission. And it was scathing. The title of the report was "When the Law Has Changed But the System Isn't." And that speaks the kind of perspective of the Ombudsman.
So the Deloitte report, as you said, pointed to these shortcomings. In your view, though, did the use of AI in that report that you uncovered ultimately undermine those actual findings of the report?
I think that's a fair proposition, but of course, I don't think it was an option for me, having discovered the AI hallucinations, as I allege they were, to simply ignore them. So I commented on them, and the rest is recent history. It's an international story, and there have been many people on social media and mainstream media lamenting the use of AI in this Deloitte report. On the other hand, the Deloitte report for those in the area is relatively well known. I think it's important that I say that the Deloitte report was much anticipated because everyone in the sector knew that of these problems and the Ombudsman's initial findings. And the report was originally, it appears, refused in response to an FOI request. And so some journalists were already primed to suspect there might be something in the report that was not ready for publication. Nevertheless, it was released in mid-August, and I discovered almost instantly upon reading it that the academic aspects of the report, because a large field of academic work in law now is devoted to the digital state, you know, automation and machine learning and computer systems that make government decisions have become utterly normative. And so the report called on some of this literature to guide its analysis of the modern social security system. But alas, many of those references were not correct.
My guest on the Radio National Hour is University of Sydney legal academic Dr. Christopher Rudge. So, Christopher, I understand the entire payment cancellation system has essentially been paused since March this year. What does that tell us about the overall integrity of the system?
I don't think there is any person in government or outside defending the system. I think there is a broad recognition that it is defective in very significant ways. And the Deloitte report itself is evidence of the deep and complex defects in the system. And these effectively run from the primary legislation, which is drafted and passed by the House of Representatives and the Senate, right through to the independent contracted providers, these private businesses that provide the services of government in attempting to facilitate job seekers to gain employment. Mm-hmm. So at every level, there are difficulties with the way that the law is being applied.
So you say there's universal belief that this cancellation system is defective. That said, are efforts underway to fix it as far as you know, or do you think it should be just scrapped altogether and the government goes back to the drawing board on this?
Well, the mutual obligation system itself is of quite a vintage now. So we go back to about the mid-90s and the early Howard years when it was introduced, this mutual obligations idea. And, you know, over time, it has become more strict and more punitive. And arguably, as much as we might hope that digitalization will aid in simplifying things, it appears in this instance it's become more and more complex because effectively decision making that might once have occurred in a room face to face with a person happens in the cloud somewhere, and redressing any errors that are made is, you know, Kafkaesque effectively. So we are in a situation now, I think, where the whatever you make of the original intention of the mutual obligations regime, which is effectively that the government has an obligation to pay Social Security. This is long recognised. It's recognised in our constitution, which was amended in 1946 to allow the Commonwealth government to pay benefits. And it's also recognised in a 1975 International Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights that Australia has ratified. That's Article 9, the right to social security. So, you know, we have a long-standing recognition that the social security safety net is a part of our Australian history and our Australian tradition of governance. And I think that whatever you make of the mutual obligation system, I think it has to be said that the obligation on the part of the government, that is to act lawfully, is not being met in this instance.
The other process you've taken issue with is income apportionment. What exactly is this?
Well, income apportionment is a different but equally significant failure in the social security system in Australia. So it was actually the subject of investigation from around 2020. Again, the Commonwealth Ombudsman raised it initially. And it's a very complicated mathematical problem with the way that debts were being calculated from at least 1991 through to 2020. In essence, it's a problem of alleging debts without sufficient evidence. What was happening was people who were receiving all kinds of social security benefits, from youth allowance through to the disability support pension, were providing details of their work income to the Department of Human Services, now Services Australia. And a person analysing the income had an option to either calculate the income when it was earned or when it was received.
Mm.
Now, sometimes, especially going back a few years, it wasn't clear on pay slips when income was earned. It might just give a number of hours worked and then give the total. Now, the pay slip could extend over a period of a month or more, in which case you wouldn't know in which fortnight it was actually earned. So the decision makers had an option. They could calculate the debts on a presumption of when it was earned, or they could calculate it on a presumption of when it was received, the income, I mean. And it's very easy to know when income's received because you've got more evidence like bank statements. Mm. But the preferred approach for many, many years was to try, notwithstanding any evidential ambiguity, to calculate it on a when earned basis. And that has created significant problems of evidence that the Ombudsman has found. And the government were looking at going back to recalculate debts from the 1990s.
That's a long period of time we're talking about, 30 years or so. In July, the Federal Court declared this income apportionment invalid. Now the government's, as you say, working on legislation to compensate affected recipients. How costly could this be?
Well, the legislation is very much the least costly thing they can do, and that's by design. So what has been conceded by everyone, the government and the Ombudsman, and I believe they have Solicitor General's advice in this matter, is that they did take the wrong approach and they have unlawfully calculated debts back to 1990. With that being said and that conclusion being accepted, the legislation that is just about to be put before the Senate actually retrospectively validates the unlawful conduct and provides those social security recipients who may be affected to apply for a resolution payment of between $200 and $600. Now, it's my strong view, based on the evidence that I've reviewed, that many, many of the millions, I think there's named about 5 million potential people affected here, or at least 5 million debts, many of those would stand to kind of have a difference in the debt calculation of more than $600. So going
that's
back...
That's a lot of money.
That's right. So going back and recalculating them would be very expensive in its own right, but so would the ultimate repayments that might fall due. So by retrospectively validating the unlawful calculation method, the government doesn't have to pay anyone to recalculate the debts manually, and it also doesn't need to pay the difference that might be discovered. They can cap it at $600. So it's something I've made submissions on, and I don't necessarily, I'm happy to say, I don't think it's the right approach to this kind of thing.
Christopher, we're talking here about legislation, systems, government decision-making, but also a very big human issue. When someone who relies on welfare has their payment cancelled or they receive an often large debt notice, what sort of an impact does that have on them?
The psychosocial or mental health impacts can be profound. There are stories, and unfortunately, is not a lot of empirical study of this, these kinds of incidents yet. But there are stories online, as well as in the Robodebt Royal Commission report, of people taking their lives and of people, finding themselves homeless, friendless, and without any family to support them. And so I think it's extremely important that, governments do follow through with the protection systems that are designed into the legislation. Mm. So that digital protections framework was there in a very clear recognition of the risks of introducing automated systems. Because, of course, A lot of the issues that arise in social security are not kind of discrete and siloed issues that only happen and only involve social security. People who are unemployed often have intersecting problems in their daily lives. Many people who might find themselves unemployed might also be the victims of domestic violence. I know, there are statistical studies going back decades showing that these cancellations and welfare injustices affect women and First Nations people, you know, in a disproportionate way compared with others. So I think it's really important that in a civilised society like Australia, we have a decent and dignified way to ensure that people aren't penalised when they're at their most vulnerable moments.
University of Sydney legal academic Dr. Christopher Rudge is with me on the Radio National Hour talking about the, sadly, many problems in our welfare system. Christopher, you've catalogued those, and given that, would you go as far as saying Australia's welfare system is in crisis?
Well, I would, because I don't think that the problems we see in the social security system are matched in any other area of government in terms of the systems that are used, and all of these defects that are kind of unguardedly conceded by government to be defects. I can't think of another area of government in which so many systemic defects exist. So I think it's fair to say it's a crisis. But I also think there is a broader problem in the way that social security is approached in Australia. I mean, I think there's an economic fiction at the base of the social policy. I think since at least the 2000s, we've treated unemployment in Australia as a personal failing that must be policed by an unlawful system. But we know that this contradicts, you know, the expertise of those at the Reserve Bank of Australia and their macroeconomic policy. For instance, the Reserve Bank treats a certain level of unemployment, for example, as a structural necessity, and they have a target rate at the moment of 4% unemployment. So if we were to actually achieve a lower unemployment rate than that target rate, if 2% unemployment was reached, for example, the RBA might well raise interest rates to cool the economy, and they say as much in their communiques. So I think there's a problem when you've got an inconsistency, what I'm calling an economic fiction, where we have a system that's doggedly penalistic and proceeds on the basis that full employment must be achieved to improve the economy. But we have on the other side our best economic experts recognising that there must be some unemployment in our society.
Christopher Rudge, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Dr. Christopher Rudge is a legal scholar at the University of Sydney. And if this conversation has raised any issues for you, help is always available. You can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. Second cities, like second children, can sometimes find themselves out of the spotlight, overlooked in favour of their brasher, bigger counterparts. Just ask the good folk of Geelong in Victoria, or Bunbury in WA, or the Gold Coast in Queensland, and you get a kind of middle child shrug, an acceptance that no, they're not the flashy star of the state, but that can have its benefits. After all, they've spent their whole lives avoiding the big smoke, and hey, who'd want to live there anyway? Yes, chips on the shoulder can also be a characteristic of this middle child. Let's call it the underdog complex. The good city of Newcastle fits neatly into this category. 2.5 hours up the motorway from Sydney, $10 and a slightly longer journey on the train, and the Novocastrian Republic slides into view. Its skyline is no longer dominated by the chimneys of the BHP steelworks. They're long gone. But what's appeared in their place? Beyond the Knights and Silverchair, what kind of city has it become? And what kind of place do the increasing number of people who call it home since COVID, many of them exiles from Sydney, want it to be? Former ABC foreign correspondent and author Scott Bevan is a proud son of the city, and he's just released a book called Newcastle, The Lives and Times of the City, published by New South. Scott, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Michael Rowland, thank you, and thank you for calling my hometown the good city of Newcastle.
It is a great city. I've spent so much time over there, happy times over the years. Great to chat to you again, Scott. Now, you make the case the city is dramatically changing. So where is that most noticeable? How would I see it, for instance, if I flew into Williamtown, took a taxi into the city tomorrow? What would I see?
Well, probably from the outside flying in, you'd think, gee, I can see a lot more. The scrim of industry has literally blown away. It's blown into the past with the closure of the BHP Steelworks in 1999. For many here, it was like, we're losing the haze, and if we've lost the haze, we've lost the look of our future. That haze equaled the future. So when suddenly everything got clearer, and for someone arriving, instead of looking at that scrim of industry, that they're going, wow, this is beautiful. Then for us, that was a bit of a concern. It was like, okay, you can see us more clearly, but where is that vision going to lead? And what's it going to mean for all of us? So you'd probably notice cleaner skies, and you would notice that instead of being a city that once hugged the ground, indeed mined under the ground, we're becoming, like many cities, a vertical city. We're reaching for the sky, many taller buildings.
So many elements I want to talk to you about this great city, but among the many conversations, Scott, you had in the book, you speak to Worimi man, Emeritus Professor John Maynard. He's the Chair of Indigenous History at the University of Newcastle. What did he tell you about pre-settlement Newcastle, and where is that still visible today?
It's under every step we take, and he makes that point. Wherever you walk here, you are walking on that First Nations land, on Worimi land, on a Awabakal land. And so talking to John, I became keenly aware of not only what was below our feet, but what remains all around us. We are and have always been a harbour town. And in talking to John and the stories of how that waterway, your harbour, as the First Nations people called it, nourished them in real ways, with food and in stories, in culture. That's all part of who we are and what we are now, as we are still very much a harbour city, as is well known. We're the largest coal export port in the world. So that's probably harbour writ large there with the exports, but in so many ways, just as it always has done for the Worimi, for the Awabakal, the harbour nourishes what this city is, as we realise this is a key element of who we are as Novocastrians. And there is a statue, Michael, in the harbour or just on the shores, and it's called Destiny. And in so many ways, that statue, by virtue of its name and the way it's looking east towards the harbour entrance, it's looking to where this city is going as a harbour city. It grew as a harbour colony, a harbour settlement, but it is in its destiny a harbour city.
I want to come back to the harbour city and the fact that it's the biggest coal export port in the world and the, I guess, mixed feelings that generates in the community there. But let's get down to tin tack, Scott. How does Newcastle today define itself against Sydney, the big smoke? It's the seventh biggest city in the country. It has serious size on a national scale, but it's a minnow compared to its near neighbour in New South Wales. Does that hold us back or is that proximity something of an asset?
I still think it's an asset. It depends who you ask. The proximity and that sense of derision we felt we got from the Emerald City, from 160 kilometres to the south, gave this city its grit. People still refer to Newcastle as gritty, as though the steelworks are still here. Newcastle still has that element of grit, but I think that grit is our determination to hold on to the fact we are not an extension of Sydney, and Lord forbid, we are not a part of Sydney. We are very much our own people and our own city. However, part of that definition lies in the fact of us going, we are not Sydneysiders. When we're not as flash, we're not as loud, and if we are loud, it's only, you know, cheering for the Knights or a rock band, or we keep that pride under check. So part of who we are is who we most assuredly are not, and that's Sydneysiders.
My former ABC colleague and proud son of Newcastle, Scott Bevan, is with me on the Radio National Hour. Scott, let's talk more about the port. It is the biggest coal export port in the world. You can hear the ships entering the harbour, blowing their horns throughout the day and night, as you well know. So it's all part of the sound of the city as well as the site. But it doesn't want to remain only an export harbour for coal. Why is that? You touched on this before, the harbour, the outlook to the sea. And who is driving it?
Oh, there is a real sense of wanting to be more diverse. And the Port of Newcastle, the corporation that in effect runs what comes in and out of here, they are very much pushing for diversification. The CEO told me that the aim is to be 50% other things by the year 2030. So while at the moment it's still overwhelmingly coal that is exported from here, more than 90%, of what goes out of the Port of Newcastle, the push is on to diversify. And that would represent, Michael, more of what's going on in Newcastle. Mm. Newcastle is a way more diverse and complex city than what it has been given credit for or what is presumed it is. It is far more than an industrial city. It's far more than Coalopolis, as it was once called because of it being a coal hub, or Steel City, as it was when the BHP was here. And we always say the BHP here. We always put the definite article before it to show its importance. It's always been far more than all of that. But now Newcastle realises in presenting itself to the world, we have to present that diversity that we've always had and that possibility and opportunity that lies in that. So I think what's happening with the harbour, or where the port wants to take it, is but a reflection of where the city wants to go as well.
On the Radio National Hour, you're hearing from writer and journalist and proud author Scott Bevan. We're talking Newcastle. One event, a tragic event, many of our listeners would associate with Newcastle is, of course, the earthquake in December 1989. It was one of my first jobs as a young journalist. I spent a few days up there in the aftermath of the earthquake outside the demolished Newcastle Workers Club. You write so movingly about this in your book. You lost a friend in that disaster. It was a seismic event in so many ways, wasn't it, for the city?
It was, because there were physical reminders that were toppling. And it was at a time where, through the 80s, the city had already ridden so many. It had been a roller coaster through the 80s for the city as it was riding the markets, the global markets, and becoming more connected to what was happening globally. And there was a lot of questioning, where are we headed as a city? And the tremors of that was nothing compared to what happened in 89. And this literally jolted the city into pulling parts of who we were down, and also almost like this shake going, all right, where are we headed in the future? In some ways, it was the lead up, the precursor, the overture to what was to come just over 7 years later with the announcement by BHP that the steelworks were to close. So it was almost like yet another quake, and this one was the great physical quake for the quake and tremor and jolt that the city was going to experience throughout the 1990s due to the economy, due to seismic shifts in boardrooms and in industrial vision for what this place would be.
And there's this group called Renew Newcastle, run by Marcus Westbury, who sounds like a fantastic character, largely responsible for creating the Newcastle we see now, right?
Well, he saw opportunity where others saw dormancy and a city in the doldrums. He thought, well, all these empty, dust-mottled buildings, these are perfect for young entrepreneurs, for artisans, for kids trying to get a start, to literally get their work shown, to get their ideas turned into something tangible that people can either buy or embrace. And so he did all this negotiating, which began with his own dreams of, I think it was starting a bar from memory, and realising, well, we can do far more.
Now, the city's been immortalised in music as well over the years. One song that springs to mind, of course, is Cold Chisel's Star Hotel. It captures the riot at that pub in 1979. It's also produced some truly amazing musicians, Silverchair, of course, among them. Mm. In its prime, there were 22 pubs where you could hear live music on a Friday night along Hunter Street, one of the main streets in Newcastle. Does that live music, entertainment legacy live on, or are there some challenges there at the moment?
Oh, Michael, it depends who you ask. You're asking a baby boomer, so of course I'm going to go, no, it's nothing like it used to be. But I've spoken to some older musicians for the book as well, some of those who were formative, including a fellow called Mark Tinson, who played in a band called Heroes that had a song called Star in the Slaughter, which was played on the very last night of the Star Hotel, just before music descended into a riot. And they talk about those days as well. And I remember it as a kid as well, Michael, that you couldn't start at one end of Hunter Street on any given night, really, not just a Friday or Saturday night. And good luck getting to the other end, having gone into each pub to hear the bands or the acts playing in each pub. It was a petri dish of talent that then made its way out into the world with the likes of the Screaming Jets and Heroes and in the 1970s Rabbit and a young folk musician called Bob Hudson, who had a number one with a song called The Newcastle Song.
Yes, a great former colleague as well. Yeah.
Indeed. And so has it changed? Yes, it's also part of the change that you will note in Newcastle. There's still a vibrant music and indeed broader cultural scene here, but that pub rock scene that existed that seemed to absolutely flourish and seem made for the times and made for this city has withered as both the times and the city have changed.
Yeah, that's a shame. Oh, I want to talk about politics briefly. Since Federation, the federal seat of Newcastle has only ever been held by Labor members. Mm. Labor won all four local seats at the last election, but the mayor is not a Labor guy. He's an independent, and for the first time in many years, that's the case. Is the politics, this traditionally Labor politics of the city, shifting with, I guess, new population moving in?
It's such an interesting question that so many have been asking, saying, well, there's all these people moving in, people with money, people with different views that haven't grown up here and therefore that aren't brushed with that tag of, well, you must vote Labor because it's presumed to be a Labor town. And in short, it's certainly at the federal level, no, it hasn't changed. At the state level, no, Labor member. But the change at the local government level tells you something about Novocastrians again, Michael. There's a bit of a sense that when it comes to federal and state politics, Novocastrians feel they have somewhat limited influence, that they can't bring about change for their own town too much. But local government is where they can ask themselves the question, what's best for Newcastle, and actually get a result. Whether it's a Labor city, you'd certainly look at the state and federal results and go, yeah, most assuredly. But if you look at local government, you go, less so a Labor city, but very much a local city.
Scott, finally, tell me about a good day in Newcastle. I've heard about this amazing and mysterious place called the Bogey Hole, instance.
The best place to start your day. Built for private pleasure, built for a commandant when this was still a dumping ground for those deemed even too bad for Sydney. Imagine what it takes to be even too bad for Sydney.
Imagine.
Imagine. Anyway, see, I'm still making Sydney cider snide remarks. I do apologise to all our Sydney listeners. But so this place was hewn from rock on a rock platform by the sea. And it was, as I say, the place where the Commandant Morissette would go to bathe. And it's tucked away at the bottom of a cliff, so nobody could have seen him there. And it would have been his private pleasure bathing area. But of course, through the years, it's changed. And now it is this wonderful, welcoming pool for people from far and wide. I, at the time of writing the book, I remember being in there once with someone who'd come from Canada originally, and we were just swimming in there. And you know that this is in so many ways like Newcastle. It's not perfectly formed, but it feels reassuringly natural underfoot. It's still got that lumpy sort of marine lifey feel on the soles of your feet, and therefore that seems to say something about the soul of the city. And you're in there with people from all walks of life, all communing, all sharing. So it says a lot about the city that you've gone from this private pool that was hewn from rock by poor convicts into this beautiful public pleasure ground that it is now, right beside the sea, and you just look out to the horizon and I'd like to think the possibilities for Newcastle, it just seems endless out there with the horizon.
What a beautiful image to leave in our listeners' minds. Scott, thank you so much for joining me.
Michael, it's been wonderful yarning with you again. And come to Newcastle. I'll take you for a swim at the bogey hole.
You're on. Scott Bevan is an ABC journalist and former foreign correspondent and the author of several books. His latest is Newcastle, The Lives and Times of a City. And that's it from me for this evening. I hope you can join me tomorrow when we take a look at the rising tensions between Venezuela and the US. Have a lovely evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.